The world was burning when Thomas Merton entered it in 1915. Born near the French-Spanish border during World War I, he arrived in what he would later describe as a place resembling hell. His early years were marked by constant movement, France, England, America, as his artist father sought inspiration and his mother succumbed to cancer when Thomas was just 6. By 15, he was an orphan, untethered and adrift. This rootlessness would define his youth, but also prepare him for his remarkable transformation. What makes Merton's journey so compelling is not just where he ended, behind monastery walls, but how thoroughly he had embraced the world he would eventually renounce. Before becoming a monk, he had tasted everything modern life offered. Intellectual ambition at Cambridge and Columbia, political radicalism, artistic pursuits, and sensual indulgence. His was not a sheltered soul who fled to religion out of fear, but one who had drunk deeply from modernity's well and found it desperately wanting. At Cambridge University, Merton descended into debauchery beneath its academic veneer. He joined drinking circles where cynicism masqueraded as sophistication and hedonism as freedom. I was systematically stamping out the last remains of spiritual vitality from my soul, he wrote. After fathering an illegitimate child, he was expelled and returned to America. At Columbia University, mentors revived his intellectual life, particularly Mark Van Doren, whose Socratic teaching developed analytical tools that later served Merton's spiritual journey. He briefly explored communism, but found it hollow. Despite outward success, writing for campus publications, maintaining an active social life, earning academic recognition, Merton described his internal state as bleeding to death. Haven't we all experienced this disconnect? The resume grows impressive while the soul withers, achievements piling up around an emptiness we can't name. In February 1937, a chance purchase changed everything. Merton bought Etienne Gilson's The Spirit of Medieval Philosophy, initially repulsed by its Catholic origins. Yet, as he read about God's self-existence, something shifted. This wasn't the superstition he'd imagined, but a concept of breathtaking philosophical depth. Physical collapse followed, with Merton fearing an ulcer. Living in constant fear, the reverse side of the pride and lust coin, he experienced what he called the closest I came to contrition. Often, our bodies must break before our souls can heal, creating openings for spiritual awakening. In Rome's ancient churches, Byzantine mosaics revealed a God of infinite power, wisdom, and love who had yet become man. One night, he felt his deceased father's presence vividly. Overwhelmed with insight into his soul's corruption, Merton truly prayed for the first time, praying out of the very roots of my life, begging liberation from the thousand terrible things that held my will in their slavery. By 1938, Merton's reading had become increasingly Catholic Hopkins, Dante, even religious sections of Joyce. That summer, curiosity led him to Mass at Corpus Christi Church near Columbia. What struck him wasn't the ritual, but the congregation, people of all ages and classes. A teenage girl kneeling in genuine prayer showed him that someone young could make worship her authentic purpose. The sermon spoke of Christ not merely as a good man, but as God Himself who had taken human nature. Merton's transformation came while reading Father Leahy's biography of Hopkins when an irresistible voice demanded, "What are you waiting for?" Despite attempts to silence this prompting, Merton finally walked to the rectory and told Father Ford, "I want to become a Catholic." After instruction, he was baptized on November 16, 1938. In confession, he tore out his sins like teeth. Then, at his first communion, "When he raised the host, Christ drew me to himself. Heaven was entirely mine." Despite his baptism's spiritual awakening, Merton soon fell into what he called anticlimax. His first year, he neglected communion, spiritual direction, and priesthood thoughts, treating Christian life as merely natural life with a supernatural mode. A pivotal conversation with his friend Robert Lax changed everything. When Merton expressed wanting to be a good Catholic, Lax challenged him. What you should say is that you want to be a saint. Merton found this absurd. How do you expect me to become a saint? Lax answered simply, by wanting to. All that's necessary is to want to be one. Don't you believe God will make you what He created you to be if you consent? In 1939, Merton felt called to priesthood, not as emotional impulse, but deep conviction. After exploring religious orders, he visited the Trappist monastery of Gethsemane in Kentucky. Though initially terrified by their austere, silent life, Merton was drawn to their authenticity. Their liturgy overwhelmed him. "See who God is," the lights and shadows seemed to say. "See Christ here on the cross." On December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, Merton spent his last peaceful Sunday at St. Bonaventure's College. When his draft examination was delayed after America entered the war, he took it as a sign to prepare for Gethsemane, giving away possessions and writing farewells. The journey felt like passing through civil, moral death. Watching armament factories, Merton felt detached. "I belong to God now. Whether monastery or Arnie camp, I was free because my life was in His hands." At Gethsemane, Merton found not a medieval dream, but cold reality, a community of imperfect people. He appreciated the novitiate's enthusiasm and their teasing in sign language. Receiving his white robe and religious name, Frater Louis, he thought, "This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it." Monastic life was physically demanding, but spiritually fulfilling. Summer brought the hardest tests, yet Merton found satisfaction in meaningful work. The sweetest moments came at day's end. Long shadows across fields, the half moon, pine scents mingling with harvest richness, crickets singing like evening prayer incense. Merton entered the monastery to escape the world, yet found himself called to engage it through writing. This created conflict. "I'm haunted by my shadow, my double, this writer who followed me into the cloister. He still tracks me, riding my shoulders like the old man of the sea." He feared writing threatened his contemplative vocation, while others insisted it was his calling. Through this struggle, Merton discovered a central paradox, withdrawing from the world favoring a more profound way to speak to it. His embrace of silence amplified his voice beyond monastery walls. By dying to ambition, he uncovered his authentic voice, one that still resonates decades later. The monastery became not an escape, but a lens for clearer vision. Through contemplation, Merton developed insights into human nature, spirituality, and social justice that proved remarkably universal. His solitude transformed into wisdom for all. Merton's journey suggests our deepest fulfillment comes from surrendering to a greater love. In our distracted age, his embrace of silence offers a radical alternative. Not escape from responsibility, but foundation for authentic engagement with the world and our souls.